Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world, with host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Fighting has picked up in recent weeks in Ukraine. The battlefield in the Donbass, a seven-year slog between Ukrainians and Russians. Russian forces have been mobilizing along the border with Ukraine, and many are wondering if Vladimir Putin is finally going to go all out in the war against Ukraine. The Crisis Next Door welcomes back Dr. Michael Mackay, a Canadian involved in Ukraine since independence, working in the country as a university lecturer, internet project director, and election observer. Dr. Mackay, it's good to have you back on The Crisis Next Door. Thanks for joining us.
It's good to be back, Jason.
Michael, the war in Ukraine is now 7 years old. That's twice as long as the battle that lasted between Nazi and Soviet forces during World War II. The battlefield has largely been static since the early days of the fighting, but it appears that could be changing with Russia's massive mobilization. Is Putin preparing for a full-on invasion rather than the approach from the 7 years where he claimed the fight was solely between Ukraine and separatists in the eastern part of the country?
Yes, he is preparing for an invasion, or I would put it as an expanded offensive, since he has already invaded. And it's of a scale that we haven't seen before. So preparing for an offensive, yes, absolutely. Does that mean he'll do it? I don't know. It depends a lot of things. I know how Putin would like it to happen. He would like there to be some provocation from the Ukrainian side that would seem to justify his offensive. But it is certainly true that he's preparing an offensive on a scale that we have not seen since 2014. We've seen more minor preparations and more minor offensives, such as last year. There was a minor offensive on the Luhansk battlefront. But this is of a scale that we have not seen in 7 years.
Do we have any firm grasp on the numbers of troops, tanks, missile launchers that are being massed along the border of Ukraine? How big of a mobilization is underway right now?
Well, the latest reports I've seen indicate that there are probably at least 100,000 soldiers in the western, well, it's the southern military district for the armed forces of the Russian Federation. But that does not include the forces that are on exercise in Belarus. And I read today that there's the Russians say that they have two armies and three airborne divisions there. And it also does not include the armies of occupation that Russia has in Crimea and in the parts of Luhansk and Donetsk oblasts that they control. So, for example, Ukrainian military intelligence assesses that in Luhansk and Donetsk alone, the Russians have probably around 35,000 personnel, which is not enough for an offensive, but it's certainly enough for an army of occupation, and they can be very quickly reinforced from across the border, which, don't forget, Russia entirely controls. From the Sea of Azov right to a point on the Seversky-Donets River east of Stanitsia Luhanska. So they can augment these 35 personnel very quickly. They're known to have over 400 tanks stationed in Donetsk and Luhansk. So this is the expected jump point, shall we say, for an offensive if it comes.
I've seen reports of Russia redeploying a flotilla of landing craft into the Sea of Azov. Could there be a possible amphibious landing as part of this invasion?
Yes, this is a new development. We have not seen this before. What you're talking about is redeploying at least a dozen landing craft from the Caspian Sea to the Sea of Azov, because the Russians can do that by rivers and canals. And they have been spotted by open source intelligence staging forces on their coast to the Sea of Azov. And this is a point that's only about 50 kilometers from Mariupol, which is held by the Ukrainians, and the front line is just slightly to the east of Mariupol. A landing force from this marshalling area on the Sea of Azov could cross the Sea of Azov in about 1 hour. So the threat is a landing west of Mariupol, so between occupied Crimea and Mariupol, and the target would be immediately to seize the last two remaining ports that Ukraine has on the Sea of Azov, which are Mariupol and Berdyansk.
What does Ukraine have in the field to oppose Russia in the Donbass?
Well, since 2018, Ukraine has organized its forces in that area as what's called the Joint Forces Operation. And that's the successor from what was called the anti-terrorist operation. And it's a really comprehensive control of Ukrainian areas of Luhansk and Donetsk oblasts. And they station troops on the battlefront, which runs from east of Mariupol up through west of Donetsk, through around Horlivka, and then across the north to a line with the Siversky-Donetsk River to the Russia-Ukraine border. The numbers vary, but we can say there's probably about 80,000 troops in the immediate area. And don't forget, the Ukrainians have their heavy weaponry stationed well back, and this is because of the Minsk Agreement. So their forces that are on the front line are light. The entire size of the armed forces of Ukraine is about 250,000 people, but it would only reach that size with full mobilization, which has not happened yet.
It brings to question, why is Kiev waiting to bring its heavy weapons to the field? I know that the Minsk Agreement called for them to be pulled back, but it's clear that Russia is mobilizing on the border. And yet Ukraine now has Javelin anti-tank missiles that it bought from the U.S., and those would be rather effective in the field. Do you think that Kiev will change its mind and bring those heavy weapons closer to the front lines?
I hope they do change their mind. I think they're making a mistake by not moving up these heavy weapons. Not only are the Ukrainians keeping their Javelin missiles behind the out of the front lines, but they're even keeping their own anti-tank guided missiles, which are the ones that they've actually used. They've never used a Javelin, but they have used Stugna P and Corsair missiles, which are from their own defense industry, to great effect. But they withdrew those last summer. I think that the Ukrainian government is trying to get credit for being a one-sided adherent to the Minsk Agreement. You know, Russia breaks the agreement, but Ukraine keeps it. But they don't get the credit. So I think there's no political advantage, and there's certainly a military disadvantage from them not deploying heavy weaponry to the front right now. Now, the Russians would try to represent this as a provocation, but of course it's no such thing. The Ukrainian forces moving within Ukraine could not possibly be considered a provocation.
Is that a so-called red line that Putin is waiting for, that he could use that to build up the moment and use that as an excuse to full-on invade?
It wouldn't be enough, which is why I think the Ukrainians should do it. No, what Putin is hoping is that the Ukrainians make a mistake What he's been doing is he's been increasing the shelling, the mining, the sniper attacks across the battlefront substantially, up to a level that we've not seen since 2014, 2015. What he's hoping is that the Ukrainians will fire back in a convincing way. Now, right now, they're just shooting back occasionally and in more of a symbolic way. But when Putin's forces attack, they fire from within occupied territory, from among the houses and the apartment buildings of the captive population. So they're using this human shield tactic. They're firing into free Ukraine from occupied Ukraine. If the Ukrainians don't shoot back, well, then they've shot at Ukrainian settlements and they've shot at Ukrainian defenders. If the Ukrainians do shoot back, they're hoping for collateral damage, to use that horrible phrase when people get, you know, wrongly injured and killed. He's hoping for that and represent that as a casus belli, because he would present it as, oh, look, the Ukrainians started this, and then that would be it. So Putin is looking for something more substantial like that. As a lot of observers, including myself, have said, what he's hoping for is a Manila incident, the way that the Soviet Union started its war against Finland in 1939 was by shelling their own town just on their side of the border, saying that the Finns had done it, and then launching the invasion, which they had prepared well ahead of time. So Putin is hoping for something like that. Don't forget, he does take his lessons from the Second World War. That is his mindset.
We have seen a steady drumbeat of Ukrainian casualties over recent weeks. Any idea on the impact on the civilian population, and any clue as to what Russian casualties are like, at least over the past several weeks as fighting has increased?
My sense is that Ukrainians are angry, very angry, because they see it, and they see these casualties of what they call our boys, and they don't see that there's a consequence for it. They don't see any sign that will stop, and certainly no sign that their compatriots in Donbass and in Crimea will be liberated anytime soon. As for Russian casualties, the Putin regime has made that a treasonable offense to report what they are. They did that quite early on in 2014. They banned a mother's group for soldiers who had been killed as being a foreign NGO, and you know what that means in the Russian Federation today. So there are signs that there are increasing Russian casualties. There have been video of what the Russians call Cargo 200. This is when they return the bodies of soldiers who are killed in zinc coffins in trucks, and they drive them back across the border. They also bury them in Ukraine, but that is mostly what they do. So a little bit of that video has crept up, so we really have no idea what the Russian casualties are.
Is there any sort of anti-war sentiment growing in Russia?
Oh, I wish there was, but there's no such thing. I saw a clip of a very brave woman doing a single-person picket in Moscow, I think it was, holding up a sign because you're not allowed to shout, and she was arrested. But this is not an anti-war movement. I think Russia had what might have been an anti-war movement as long as Boris Nemtsov was alive. But after he was assassinated in February 2015, there's just no sign of an anti-war movement in Russia. They are bombarded with anti-Ukrainian propaganda. The news, the international news, actually the domestic news, is entirely about Ukraine right now. And it's all the drumbeats of war.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about the Russian troop buildup on the border with Ukraine with Dr. Michael Mackay, a Canadian involved in Ukraine since independence, working in the country as a university lecturer. The Western media often describes the war as a fight between Ukraine and Russian-backed separatists. How has that message mischaracterized the war, and how has that aided Moscow?
Oh, it has aided Moscow tremendously, because this is their propaganda effort. It needs to be clear that this is completely false. There are no separatists in the east of Ukraine. There is no separatist movement. This is not a rebel army. These are soldiers who are completely subordinate to the armed forces of the Russian Federation. They are commanded by Russian officers. They are paid by Russia. They are armed by Russia. They are a mixture of regular troops, irregular troops, mercenaries. Yes, there are some locals who have been recruited. They are mercenary soldiers. But in every way, we have to say that an army that is completely subordinate to a national power, as this army is, it is a Russian army. So the separatist narrative has allowed the Putin regime to get away with murder, literally to get away with murder, and to misrepresent this war. You see, a state of war should have been declared 7 years ago. So if you can imagine, this is as if Germany had invaded Poland in 1939, said, oh, we're going there to support Danzig, which they in fact did. They said that, but no one bought it. And 7 years later, so in 1946, people were arguing, oh, what's the nature of this war that's going on in Europe kind of thing. But in fact, France and Britain declared war on Germany 4 days after they did that. Over 7 years after Russia invaded Ukraine, not only can nobody call it a war, but we're lying about the army of occupation and calling them separatists. This has been enormously damaging to Western democracies and enormously beneficial to the Putin regime.
And speaking of Western democracies, given that Ukraine is not a full-fledged member of NATO, would any other nations come to its defense? Any of the Baltic nations or Poland, perhaps? And what do you make of Germany and France in how they've handled the situation in Ukraine?
Well, you know, it's very interesting that we're back to 19th century politics in a way, in an era when it's national interest, great powers. And so will Poland intervene? Yes, in the 19th century way, if they see their interests as being threatened, which they have said that they do. So, for example, that's one of the reasons why they oppose Nord Stream 2. That's one of the reasons why they participate in the Lithuania-Poland-Ukraine brigade. That's one reason why they support training at the base in Western Ukraine, the NATO training base, along with the United States, Canada, and Lithuania. If there is real support for Ukraine, it will be outside the structures that we've come to rely on since the end of the Second World War. It will be outside NATO because Ukraine isn't in NATO. It will be outside the UN because Russia has a veto in the Security Council. It will be outside the OSCE because Russia has a de facto veto because of the unanimity rule there. It will be outside the Council of Europe because Russia was readmitted and sanctions were dropped. So every international organization has failed. So if there is real support for Ukraine, it will be in this old 19th century great power manner.
President Biden talked with Putin today about the troop buildup. Do you think Biden in any way could sway Putin away from an invasion?
He might. And I think he has a better chance than Obama and certainly Trump, who would never dream of discouraging Putin and doing anything. I think yes, because more than I think any recent president that I can think of, President Biden understands Ukraine. He's been there many times. He was there many times during the Obama administration when President Obama never visited once. He was there during the Revolution of Dignity, so he understands What motivated that? What the Yanukovych regime was about? And he was there to give the support, such as it was, for Western powers as Russia invaded in 2014. So I think it's hopeful. I can't think of any more recent president who is better positioned to do this.
What's the best course of action for Biden in preventing Putin from making that move? A show of force, or something that's actually more forceful, such as a potential cyber attack or something along those lines?
I think he should consider all options. And a show of force, yes. So, for example, sea breeze exercises should be moved up. They should be held now. This is mostly a naval component, but also a land component with Ukraine, along with many NATO partners. For the current exercise, over 33 countries have currently been signed up for it, which is substantial. So move up these. As for a cyber attack, yes, we know that Russia has already engaged in cyber warfare. It attacked the United States successfully last year and caused enormous damage. So the cyber war is already on. So something demonstrative would be very effective. So yes, I think Biden should consider all options, and he should make it clear about what he's doing. You know, again, it's 19th century power politics all over again. It's an ultimatum. If you do this, we will do that.
Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky has been under fire for some recent pictures purportedly taken along the front lines in the battlefield, yet as it turned out, they were taken nowhere close to the front lines. And he's also been photographed not wearing the Ukrainian flag on his uniform. How would you describe Zelensky as a wartime leader?
Well, he doesn't even describe himself that way. So I think we have to start with that. He presented himself in 2019 as the candidate of peace, but without a real peace plan. And he won largely on the strength of that. So he's always been adverse to casting himself as a war leader. But in fact, he is. He is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Ukraine. Ukraine is at war, and it is his duty to uphold the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. So my assessment of President Zelensky as a war leader is quite negative. I think that Ukraine is in a very bad way. I think that we're in kind of a position like Britain was in at the start of the First World War, probably worse. But at least Chamberlain had the wisdom to realize once the war that started, which don't forget, he pushed to have it declared, recognizing his mistakes of the previous years. But he realized it was his time to step down in the Conservative Party in the UK and for Winston Churchill to take over. I don't think Zelensky has that wisdom. And I'm very pessimistic about him as a war leader.
Michael, how are the Ukrainian people holding up with this potential larger war at their doorstep? Is there fear in the air around Western Ukraine, or is there the willingness to take on this fight and somehow prevail?
There's worry. There's concern. Everybody knows somebody in the armed forces, a relative, a friend. But the Ukrainians are remarkably resilient. And when they see things like this, they put this in a historical context. They know their history. They'll say, yeah, this is bad, but we faced worse. We faced complete invasion and occupation by Russia. We faced genocide in the Holodomor. So, yes, it could get very bad, but as they say in their national anthem, Shtena merla Ukraina, which roughly means Ukraine is not dead yet. It's this incredible stubbornness. So they will talk about, well, suppose Russia does completely succeed in their offensive. Well, well, then we'll move to a guerrilla war. Just like the Ukrainian insurgent army moved from open military operations to guerrilla war in 1947 against the Soviet occupiers. So that's the context they put it in. We will fight. And yes, they would like Western democracies to support them. They think they should. They think they should have good reasons to, but they will fight no matter what.
A stubbornness born of generations of tragedy, to be sure. And although a very ominous buildup on Ukraine's border, we can certainly hope that right now it is a big bluff from Putin. Dr. Bakai, once again, thank you very much for joining us here on The Crisis Next Door.
Thank you very much.
We've been joined by Dr. Michael Mackay, a Canadian involved in Ukraine since independence, working in the country as a university lecturer, internet project director, and election observer. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly. If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly.